But the fact is that they are outsourcing their vaccine production to facilities in Europe and in other parts of North America. But the truth is that Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Moderna are off a piece. What they're doing is to say, we're not going to provide access contracts. We're not going to provide licensed manufacture of our vaccine to anyone in order for them to be able to supply the regions that they're in. We're just going to make the largest number of vaccines that we can under our control and then send them where we want. Now, the irony of this is that unlike Pfizer and Moderna, whose vaccines remain robustly desirable in the United States and Europe, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, in fact, is not. There's poll after poll that shows that it's the least desirable vaccine among ordinary Americans, for instance. And it's not like there is surging demand for the vaccine in Europe either. So it's a bit of a conundrum, because with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, no one seems to want it in the United States. No, it doesn't seem to be able to make its own vaccine. It supplied less than 10% of what it was supposed to the U.S. It supplied under 25% of what it was supposed to Europe. And yet, at the same time, there are studies from South Africa now that show that the vaccine adequately does its job in protecting people against hospitalization and death and even transmission. So there are lots of people in a majority of the world who would love to have the J&J vaccine, except they can't. And so I think it's a particularly absurd situation that Johnson & Johnson would choose to make vaccines in a part of the world that desperately needs them and then send them to another part of the world that not only doesn't need them, but doesn't seem to want them.
Achal, just put this in human terms. Who gets the vaccine, who has access to it, the percentages that we're talking about in Africa, in Asia, compared to the United States and Britain, where they've already started the booster on a mass scale, the third shot?
There's something astonishing about September 2021, because now we'll be nearing 10 months into a world in which vaccines exist and were available. And yet the death toll remains 10,000 people a day, and that's largely because less than 3% of the population of the African continent has been vaccinated, less than 15% of the Indian population has been vaccinated, while between 50 to 70% of the adults in the United States and Europe have been vaccinated. So what we're looking at is a world in which the pandemic is under control, with occasional flare-ups and alarms and problems around mass vaccination, but nevertheless, relatively under control in the US and Europe, and absolutely not under any kind of control in a majority of the world, where the majority of the world's population lives. In such a situation, what Johnson & Johnson did in South Africa, which it had to backtrack on, which was to send 300 million doses, which could have vaccinated 300 million people, because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is single dose, to send those vaccines to Europe in majority was a mistake. They were called out, people were outraged, and they backtracked. But now they're set to repeat exactly the same action with vaccines for 600 million people in India. And the absurdity of the situation and the inability of Johnson & Johnson to see how absurd it is, I think, is astonishing. But what's worse is actually that we have now, thanks to the Russians and thanks to the Sputnik V vaccine, which showed good efficacy.
We have 10 seconds.
Unfortunately, has run into production problems. We have 34 manufacturers around the world who can produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so what they should do is to expand their manufacturing to include these manufacturers. Then we could actually make that vaccine work in the world. It would be good for them. It would be good for us.
Achal Prabhalar, we want to thank you so much for joining us from Bangalore, India. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States, trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class of society consists of, it doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with the political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assembly, so we can talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government and the private sector. The famous revolving door, where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions, where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich, but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs that ran things. Essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late 70s, they were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They went to the same schools. They married out of the same pool. They belonged to the same clubs. They summered in the same vacation spots. Now it's a much more, divided by business sector, by geography. Not like the old WASPs based in the Northeast. It's much more geographically divided and much more, I think, politically divided class as well. When we talk about the divisions in the society, elite pundits are constantly complaining about how we just can't get together and have common ground and govern in a responsible, civilized fashion. I think a lot of that is traceable to the fact that the elite is just not the unified force that it once was through the late 20th century. It's just much more of a fragmented, RV's new rich crowd that is not really governing very coherently. And we can see that in the increasing chaos of American governance, which Trump represented some kind of climax. Now, Biden looks like a return to normalcy in some sense, but we'll see how long that lasts.
What happened to this coherent ruling class, and with what was it replaced?
Well, several things happened. One was that the WASPs got decadent. They became much more interested in the arts than in owning and governing things. Their wealth was divided by inflation and inheritance. Some of the industries that they were based in faced a lot of competition in the 70s onwards. Old line industry, where a lot of them were based, got shaken up. And the comfortable old world of Wall Street that they inhabited, and you could just pop out of Yale and end up as a bomb salesman and have a comfortable life for 40 years and retire, that all got blown up. Starting with the deregulation of finance in the 70s, it became a much more competitive, bloodthirsty, market-driven affair, not the relationship-driven thing that it was for so long. So there was that. Then the fact that other ethnic groups really began to assert themselves and rise in the society and develop. We saw the rise of new fortunes beginning in the 1980s with Mike Milken and the leveraged buyout craze. It's hard to think of this now, but there's basically no such thing as a billionaire going back to the early 80s when Forbes first started doing its 400 list of the richest families in the country. You could get on that list with a few hundred million dollars, and now it's just, the cutoff is in the billions. So there's a growth of this whole new rich class that wanted government out of the way. They really thought, the market could do everything, they could do everything, and that all the WASP ethic of stewardship, which lent at least some degree of civilization to their governance style, that all got blown up, too, in the mantra that greed is good. So, the combination of the decline of the old order and the creation of all these new fortunes, much of which got a political expression on the right, that's important. Some of these new fortunes really had no tolerance for the old-style kind of bipartisan comity that dominated much of U.S. politics in the mid and late 20th century. They really were bomb throwers and wanted a revolution. They got one with Reagan, and that new wealth has continued to be very, very dominant, especially in the right end of the political spectrum.
We're speaking with Doug Henwood. Doug, in the past, the ruling class members preferred to hide their existence. It was a break from this when the Rockefeller oil heir, Nelson Rockefeller, was elected to be the governor of New York State. He aspired to the presidency. And then recently we've had billionaire Bloomberg as the mayor of New York City, and then Trump as the president. Elon Musk, the second richest person in America, recently hosted Saturday Night Live. How do you appreciate this change?
It is a remarkable change. Elites, the old WASP elite, did serve in public office. The Federal Reserve, for example, was largely, the creation of the Federal Reserve was largely spearheaded by Nelson Aldrich, who gave Nelson Rockefeller his first two names in the early part of the 20th century. But much more subtly, much more under the radar. These people thought ostentation and display was very embarrassing. Joke about the only time your name should appear in the newspaper is for a wedding announcement and your obituary. That was certainly a dominant thinking among a lot of the old establishment, that they do everything quietly behind closed doors. It's vulgar, and you don't want to attract attention to yourself for political reasons, because that could just inspire resentment and rebellious thoughts, but also because they had a notion of good taste involving a good bit of repression, whereas this new class is really just loves to display its wealth. The old WASPs love to hide behind thick bushes and stuff and keep their houses out of view, and now the whole idea is to show how rich you are. William Grider made an interesting point in his book on the Fed from the 1980s. He said the old architecture style of banks used to be solid. They would look like tanks. They were pretty short and solid, and they're supposed to look sober and really well-founded. Whereas with as finance exploded, starting in the 70s and into the 80s, the new style of the bank was the skyscraper going to the sky. It was really much more about ostentatious and wealth display than creating that sense of solidity and permanence. And that's, you know, that ethic now just pervades that whole class. Elon Musk is a really excellent example of that. You know, the guy is on Twitter driving up the value of Bitcoin one day, driving down the value of Bitcoin the next day, and then, you know, driving up Dogecoin and driving down Dogecoin. It's just it's a very different way to relate to the masses, partly because, you know, the technological changes in the communications world, but it's also a change in the sensibility of the very rich. Now, I would say that Trump certainly embodies a lot of that, but there's a real question how rich he is. Michael Bloomberg always teases Trump by saying he's not really a billionaire. He may have a point about that, but I guess we'll find out when Tish James completes her investigative work.
Doug Henwood, I think one of the turning points, all this has sometimes been exaggerated, but nevertheless, it's significant. What happened in 1971 with the Powell Memorandum? Give us the background to that and how things changed afterwards.
Well, Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer in Richmond and eventually was appointed to the Supreme Court. But he wrote a memo to a friend of his at the Chamber of Commerce. Now, the Chamber of Commerce is a really old line organization that kind of looked very stodgy at that point. They had never really made peace with the New Deal, whereas much of the corporate class, they didn't love it, but they'd made peace with it and learned to live with it. But there were some hardcore conservative business interests that never really made that kind of peace, and the Chamber of Commerce was that kind of old-school organization. But Powell's memo early in the decade, 1971, you know, we'd see a lot more of this subsequently, so he really was a pioneer in this. But he was concerned that capitalism was in very ill repute, and that everywhere from college campuses to pulpits, capitalism and business interests were losing respect, being denounced. Powell was very, very concerned about this and thought that the capitalists needed to organize, defend their economic system, and get out a different kind of propaganda. You know, a distinction in contrast with what we're hearing coming out of the 1960s, the critique of the money culture. And yeah, people do assign perhaps too much causation to Powell's memo and the process of reaction that set in as the 1970s progressed, but it was an important milestone in that. We'd see, you know, things, the Business Roundtable, the founding of the Business Roundtable a few years later, which was an organization of big CEOs to push for a different kind of policy that was much more business-friendly than that we were seeing in the 60s and early 70s. You know, there are many more developments along those lines as the decade went on, but Powell certainly was a pioneer in that corporate reaction.
Talk about the transition of both the Republican and the Democratic parties over the last several decades. How have they both changed, and who do they represent now?
Well, it's hard to say. The Democratic Party in the last few years has changed from what I'm about to say. And it's really hard to measure just how deep that change is or how long-lasting it is, but it's definitely, there are forces within the Democratic Party now to the left of anything we've seen in a long time. But what happened with that party was, Lily Geismer has a very good book on this, a historian, has a very good book, I think it's called Don't Blame Us, came out a few years ago, about what happened to the Democratic Party starting in the 1970s. The role of the urban working class and the associated political machines was really downplayed, and the unions, and they got nudged aside as the kind of professional class in elite suburbs became a much more important force within the party. And her book is a study of five towns north of Boston where that kind of elite suburban, not, you know, boring gray flannel suburban. They thought of themselves as intellectuals, MIT professors, Harvard professors, engineers, not your vulgarian from Great Neck or something like that, but a much more posh kind of notion of what the suburbs are all about. And they were the classic combination, which we've come to be very familiar with in the last 30, 40 years, socially liberal, but fiscally conservative. So, for example, town Lexington, Massachusetts, one of the ones that Geismar studied, was all about like combating housing discrimination. But the problem is that very few black people could afford a house in Lexington, Massachusetts. So you can be, you know, as anti-racist as you want, but if people can't buy a house in your town, then it's largely symbolic. So that kind of politics became very much larger than the Democratic Party. Also, starting after a series of defeats, the Democratic Party elites decided that they needed to throw out the old New Deal, Great Society, civil rights side, and become much more Wall Street friendly and tough on crime and tough on defense. And the Democratic Leadership Council, which Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were early founders and shapers, really transformed the party. Now, of course, we've seen different things happening now with the rise of Sanders, the Squad, Democratic Socialists of America, operating in part through the Democratic Party, has threatened that DLC structure, but it dominated the Democratic Party for decades. Now, the Republican Party is a very interesting story. Going back in the 50s into the 60s, there was not all that much difference between the two parties. They had a liberal wing and a conservative wing, but there was not the kind of geographic and class stratification or separation between the parties that we see now. And one of the reasons for that was that there was a very conscious effort on the part of a bunch of conservatives to take over the party. They hated Eisenhower. They hated the kind of accommodation with the New Deal that Eisenhower represented. They, starting in the 50s, with great discipline and long-term goals in sight, moved to change the party from within. Some of them were actually ex-Bolsheviks, ex-communists, ex-Trotskyists, and they brought with them that organizational and ideological discipline that came from having been in those sorts of formations, brought that to their attempt to turn the Republican Party into a much more explicitly right-wing formation. And it took them a couple of decades. They got the Goldwater nomination in 64. Goldwater got beaten, but 16 years later, their man Reagan won and really did a lot to transform American politics to this day, and world politics even. So it's a very successful counter-revolution from within. And one of the things that was striking about that, which is something in a sharp contrast with people on the left who are trying to change the Democratic Party, the conservatives trying to change the Republican Party didn't mind playing the spoiler role. They didn't mind nominating a right-winger like Goldwater who would lose because they thought that the long-term fight was worth that kind of sacrifice. People in the left wing of the Democratic Party are often very reluctant to play that spoiler role. When William Buckley ran for mayor of New York City in 1965, he ran against John Lindsay, a very liberal Republican. And Buckley knew that he could draw votes away from the Republican and make a Democrat mayor, but he didn't care. He wanted to destroy liberal Republicanism, and that was a much more important goal to him. So I would say that the right, as odious as they are, does have a much greater sense of organizational and ideological discipline and an eye to the long term that is lacking on the left side of the spectrum often. I wouldn't say anything about the right having, you know, kind of long-term sense right now. The right, the right wing of the Republican Party is largely insane. But going back in the decades, they really had a vision of what they wanted to happen and were quite successful in making it happen.
How does the capitalist class rule? Please talk about their think tanks, university positions, ownership of the media, and the use of lobbyists in Congress and at the state level. How do they rule?
They dominate the policymaking process. They they pay for politicians, campaign finance. The politicians are largely bought and paid for. The right, especially, has produced this amazing machine for writing legislation. At the state and local level, the American Legislative Exchange Council, sponsored by Koch and other right-wing money, has all these ready-made bills. So, for example, now we're seeing this wave of anti-trans legislation in about 25 states across the country. They're all very similar. It's because these organized interests have been pushing this agenda to the point where they actually write the bills. A lot of state legislatures just don't have the staff necessarily or the expertise to write legislation. These outside experts do it for them. But then if you the more respectable side of the political spectrum, you've got institutions like the Brookings Institution or the Center for American Progress, which are kind of center-left liberal, produce safe kinds of policies for Democratic governments to adopt. So they serve this role of forming political consciousness, shaping discourse, and sort of mapping out the limits of what's acceptable in mainstream politics. Then, of course, there's the media, which just bellow endless propaganda about everything. They've lost an awful lot of respect over the last decade or so, but they still have considerable influence. And, you can see that most significant policies that get adopted at the federal and state level reflect the interest of top couple of percent of the population. The broad populace has little influence on that sort of thing. And it's a matter of personnel. The politicians that hold office or the experts that they rely on all come out of a certain narrow set with who think similarly and really don't have the interests of the broad public at heart. They have the interests of their special groups at heart. But one of the things that's happened in the last several decades is that elites have lost, or economic elites have to some degree lost interest in shaping legislation. They're all interested in what will affect them as an industry or as a company. But they since the early 1980s, when they won pretty much everything in the Reagan Revolution, they've demobilized a bit, and there's not a broad vision of what they think the society should look like. And partly as a result of that, there's just been this loss of consensus throughout the rest of the society. There's not this unified propaganda that has influenced the way people think on the day-to-day level, the way there was in the early neoliberal era, when Reagan and Thatcher revolutions transformed the common sense of the masses. People internalized a whole lot of market doctrine, doctrine about self-reliance, distrust of government, distrust of politics. People internalized a lot of that propaganda, and now they're pretty alienated from it. They have seen the world that kind of consciousness created and don't like it.
From what you've said, the project of overturning class rule and forming a truly democratic society seems enormous. Where do we go from here?
Know the answer to that. The last line of the piece, which is that in Jacobin, which is that it's much easier to mount a revolution from within the ruling class than against it, I must say, was written by Bhaskar Sankara, the publisher and editor of Jacobin, and I'm very grateful for it because it's true that it is much easier to mount a revolution within the ruling class than against it. The only thing I can think of is just organization, persistent organization and demands, and we've seen some of that in recent years, the growth of socialist tendency within the American politics, certainly small, weak, geographically dispersed, but it's something. And we're seeing some changes. The kinds of ambitious, don't want to call them New Dealish, but steps in that direction that Biden has taken on domestic policy. His foreign policy remains appalling, but his domestic policy is certainly better than anything I expected. I think that reflects this kind of organization, and also the desperation of the moment, but it does that there's just a different level of political organization and political consciousness in the country, and the more, we just need more of it, much more of it. That kind of organization is going to start low. The Sanders campaign did catalyze a whole lot of political consciousness, political organization, but the real change is going to come from below. We need to organize at the state and local level, transform state legislatures and city councils, which are much more amenable to agitation coming from the left. Move up the political ladder. And I guess that's really about the only way we can get any kind of long-term progress, because despite erosion than the rod of a ruling class, it's still quite powerful and dominates an awful lot of policymaking and our consciousness formation, unfortunately.
How can people follow your work?
Just about everything I do is noted or promoted on my blog, lbo-news.com. That's lbo-news.com. That's an easy way to keep up with everything. Or on Twitter at Doug Henwood is the account name.
Been great to have you on Law & Disorder. Thank you so much. You take it easy.
You too. Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Whistleblowing Australian journalist and the publisher of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, sits in a jail cell in solitary confinement in London's infamous Belmarsh prison. There he awaits the decision of the British High Court as to whether, at the behest of the Trump and now Biden administrations, he will be extradited to the Eastern District of Virginia to stand trial on 17 counts of espionage under the recently resurrected 1917 Espionage Act, which was originally enacted to be used against spies. He will certainly be sentenced to imprisonment for the rest of his life in a supermax security prison where communications with the outside world will be cut off. His case is on appeal to the British High Court. At the recent extradition hearing, British magistrate Vanessa Beritzer ruled in favor of the United States on all of the 17 counts of espionage lodged against him by the Trump administration. She did, however, rule that Julian Assange would be subjected to terrible conditions in an American Maximax security prison and therefore should not be expedited. The Biden administration has appealed this ruling. The charges Assange faces are a major threat to press freedom. Attorney James Goodale, who represented the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, commented, quote, "The charge against Assange for conspiracy with a source is the most dangerous I can think of with respect to the First Amendment in all my years representing media organizations. It is crucial to build support for Assange and prevent his delivery into the hands of a Biden administration and its prosecutors. Julian Assange's crime was to expose the war crimes, murder, and the inner workings of the American empire to the world press. He might pay for this embarrassment with his life." Today, we talked to John Shipton, Julian's father. He's in America from his native Australia, touring to raise support for his victimized son. John Shipton, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Pleasure.
John, your son, Julian Assange, was a young computer genius. He developed a way to make illegal government action transparent while at the same time protecting the whistleblowers who were the source about these illegal government actions. Please talk to us about what Julian did to bring down on his head the wrath of the powerful American empire.
Well, there are two elements there, Mike. One is the using Tor, which was the onion router, to provide anonymity to those that would like to leak information or other methods. So whatever it was, the person who provided the insight to the leaks would be protected and remain anonymous. Secondly, and this is a really interesting piece, that if you hold up on the internet, the leaks as a library, then in open source methods, a wiki can establish itself and all of us can participate in the analysis of that information. Consequently, it improves the public's understanding of policy and also enables the public, or the polity, if you like, to participate more accurately in democracy. Both of those things really important.
What's the legal status of his case now, John?
Julian won his extradition case against the United States, and the judge ruled that Julian could not be extradited to the United States on account of health reasons, that he would be put in Colorado for max under SAMS regulation, special administrative measures, and consequently would be liable to suicide. So that was appealed by the United States, and the Crown Prosecuting Service in the UK said that the appeal, whether the appeal can go ahead, will be heard sometime this week by a single High Court judge. This week, more maybe, you know, you can't rely on these people, but this week, the High Court judge will make a decision as to whether the American appeal against non-extradition can go ahead. The appeal itself would be in autumn, well into autumn, the hearing of the appeal, should the judge give permission.
So in the meantime, Julian is sitting in solitary in Belmarsh Prison and will have to stay there at least until the fall.
Yes, it's very odd that they don't give him permission to bail. I mean, it's very odd that he's in there anyway. But adding to that procedural irregularity, Julian can't go anywhere because in any nation that Julian went to would immediately be faced with an extradition request by the United States. So there's no good reason for Julian to be held away from his family, his new children and his partner. No good reason at all. We think it's malice.
He spent 7 years in two small rooms in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been given political asylum by the Ecuadorian government. Then he was forcibly removed to Belmarsh prison. He had no sunlight, could not go out for medical care. How's his health now?
Not the best. The review of Julian's health by the United Nations Rapporteur on Torture, Professor Nils Melzer of Glasgow University, is accurate. And Professor Melzer took along two experts who evaluated Julian's well-being after 11 years of, at that stage, 10 years of arbitrary detention, and determined that Julian was suffering the physical and mental effects of torture. The sort of torture was mobbing, calumny, and endless procedural irregularities with no end in sight as to when he was going to be freed or what was going to happen to him, other than another court case following another court case. Each of those cases had procedural irregularities embedded within them. That's deliberate.
Let's talk about what underlied Julian's actions, please, John. What do you know about Julian's beliefs and his values? You raised him. You're his father. How did he grow up to be this extraordinarily admirable person?
Well, this is mostly, entirely, actually, his mother's doing. She, Christine inculcated into Julian a love of justice and also the strength within the soul to be able to tell the truth. Of course, telling the truth is very hard work, as you know, because it can get you into awful trouble, as demonstrated by Julian's 11-year circumstance. But anyway, that's his nature, to speak truthfully and to hunger for justice and to use all of the strength in his arm to ensure that those who suffer injustice are given relief.
Tell us about his companion, Stella Morris. She's the mother of their two small children. And also tell us about his half-brother, your son, Gabriel Shipton.
Well, Stella, a lovely woman. She's a trained lawyer. She's born, her father's Cuban and her mum is Catalan from Barcelona. She speaks Swedish and Spanish and English. Her studies were in law at Oxford University. So she's bright, devoted, and has a very, very close family. So she doesn't have to, in her travels and fighting for her lover, she doesn't have to worry about having people to look after the children or the home falling into disrepair as her family gather around her and her sister. That has circumstances has given immense strength to Stella and consequently to Julian. Gabriel is 39 now. He's a film producer. This is normally what they call feature-length films, fictional films, but this time he is embarked on a documentary which of my and Stella's actions in order to get Julian freed. So it's interesting in as much as that it's in the United States, all of Europe, Australia and the UK, these two, Stella and myself, followed by cameramen, fighting in every way we can to get the news out and to thank people for their support. Yeah, it's been very rewarding to work so closely with Gabrielle.
John, what kind of support has been shown to you and your family and to Julian so far on your tour here in the United States?
Oh, excellent. You know, we just had, we stayed in the Haitian Quarter in Miami, and we were housed by Medea Benjamin, the convener of Code Pink. Then, oddly enough, we formed a bridge. So we had tremendous reception at the Bitcoin conference, who are mostly libertarians. Code Pink are pacifists or anti-war, really, not pacifists. And they slightly to the left of center. So we formed a bridge between those two disparate groups. So that was great in Miami. In Boston, we were at the Boston Common, 1634, a historical place to have a meeting in. And we have Richard Stallman, probably one of the brightest men in America, and Jill Stein, numerous others supporting us. And off we go in a minute to a church down the road where Julian will be given the Zacco and Vanzetti Prize for social contribution. Last year, the person who received it was Daniel Ellsberg. So, you know, very proud pantheon of defenders of the fundamental values of the United States.
What kind of international support is Julian getting?
Now, this is the good bit. Worldwide, as it's a global problem, we started work in Europe. And as it's a global problem, in particular, the focus of Europe is that they see it as their problem because WikiLeaks was first registered in France, although the website itself is registered in California. The first court case for publishing was fought in France. The publications were Le Monde, Der Spiegel, Guardian. All of the employees were Europeans and English people, United Kingdom people. So they saw it as persecution of Julian and WikiLeaks with the publications. They saw it as a European problem, which of course it is. So the Council of Europe made a strong statement in defense of Julian. Every single journalist association in the Western world have made statements of support. 24 of the world's largest NGOs put a letter into the New York Times. The German Parliament has a cross-party group. The French Parliament has a cross-party group. The Spanish Parliament has a cross-party group. Just this morning, the United Kingdom Parliament had a cross-party group, and they had a meeting which we were invited to and attended. In Australia, there's 212 parliamentarians in total, 26 of those are supporters. The opposition party, which is the equivalent of the Democrats in Australia, made a declaration of support. The leader of the opposition made a declaration of support. All of the Greens are supporters. So the vigour from the polity, encouraging politicians in a classic working of democracy, that vigour has sort of an upwelling or an inflowing tide of support, which of course has kept us going because we can't go on without their support. I'm a retired man, a pensioner, so we depend upon contributions from people which have been forthcoming to make these trips and these actions possible. So worldwide, the global problem is receiving global support. The first person to realize that it was a global problem was James Goodall, who was the lawyer for the New York Times when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. So significant in every direction.
How can people contribute to your effort and show their support? Do you have a website?
Yes, we do. Have a website, AssangeCampaign.com. I'll ask Gabrielle, homerunforjulian.com. There's so many of them that I tend to forget them, but this one is homerun, the figure four, julian.com.
I'm going to ask you that again at the end of our interview, John, but I wanted people to get ready and have a pen if they need it. John Chipton, if the Biden administration prevails and Julian loses his appeal and he's sent back to the Eastern District of Virginia for trial, where he most certainly will be found guilty, what does this mean to the freedom of press and for our right to hear? Isn't this really a fundamental question of democracy?
Indeed it is. And it goes, geez, this is a deep, this is a real rabbit hole that, have a look down this hole. In the first place, Julian has about 100 lawyers in jurisdictions in seven countries. The cost is millions of dollars. And Julian is being pursued as an individual, okay? Not WikiLeaks, but as an individual. The consequence of this is that every journalist in the world who picks up a pencil or opens the keyboard will face the wrath of the Department of Justice if they write anything that's critical of the United States, or even the United States, critical of Washington, or critical of what Washington does, or it analyzes policy to illuminate what Washington wants to do or is doing, will face the wrath of the Department of Justice. Very few people, very few individual journalists, and I stress this, that the attack is against an individual doing. Very few can have 100,000 people assisting worldwide and raise money and also get the assistance of many, many lawyers who work pro bono or for very little money, because of the depth of understanding that this is a global problem with the repression of comment, the intimidation of journalists, and the ruination of democracy. The great beauty of democracy is that knowledge brings freedom. So this is, I think, Prometheus Unbound from the poet Shelley. Knowledge will bring freedom. And bringing that knowledge is, of course, the great calling of journalists, to bring knowledge to us so that we can discuss amongst ourselves and formulate opinions and understandings of government action or what we would like government to do or not do. Also, this brings benefit to the polity and brings benefit to government because it has at its core an educated populace. And with an educated populace, that means a higher quality of parliamentarian, or I think in the United States we call them congressmen. So, and also a more educated and aware institutions of state. That this is so important. But I remember back in the 60s and 70s, the tremendous intellectual ferment emitting from mostly California into the world and shaped the modern world. In a sense, we are all Californians, you know, we dress casually most of the time. We are concerned with cuisine. We like to have variety in our cuisine and variety in our visual field. Many things like that, emitting or a sort of understanding of the body, understanding of the physics of the world, you know, that Fritjof Capra's book or Alan Watts's book or Gregory Bateson's book, many profound understandings moving into the world live in a lively fashion because the United States, in its wisdom, allowed freedom of the press. That beautiful thing is now at risk. I don't know why they have decided to place it at risk in Washington, but it's a disaster. Outside of the United States, what we envy of the United States and agitate in our own countries for is a First Amendment, free speech, and a Bill of Rights. These are the great civilizational artifacts of the United States that we outside the United States wish that we had for ourselves.
John Shipton, the last time you visited your son, Julian, in prison, what were the conditions like? And what was it like? What did you speak to him about? And how was he doing?
Oh, it's a little shop of horrors, the jail. And, you know, they've got... You go through four portals, you're searched and x-rayed again. And then a dog sniff comes up. You go into a room with the other poor buggers. Julian, you know, you embrace and sit down, but you're overheard. And there's cameras in the high fidelity, actually, cameras in the ceiling so they can lip read if you try and whisper. Those are circumstances. I last visited in March last year. Julian hasn't had a visitor, legal or otherwise, since October last year. We hope that that circumstances, I mean, there's a COVID infestation in the jail amongst the staff and the prisoners. So we hope that that circumstance will be resolved very soon. That's the circumstance of Julian's incarceration. Not good.
John, can you repeat again the website so that our listeners can support Julian Assange?
Yes, thank you, Mike. I hope I haven't tested your patience here. But the website that we are running for this tour of the United States is homerun4julian.com.
I wanted to ask you if you had any final thoughts for our audience.
Yeah, this it's a symbol or iconographic symbol of an attitude to our ability to ordinarily have illuminated and erudite discussions with each other based upon the information we can get at. The oppression of this is very worrying for our future and our, for the present. We want to know what's going on. And Washington, in its wisdom, have decided that we can't. This we must fight with all our strength to ensure that we can, again, participate in our own communities, and the communities themselves can generate creatively understandings. Like, for example, the latest one is distributed systems, and find how a distributed system works and what the benefits it will bring us. Very important.
John Shipton, we so admire you, and we here at Law and Disorder are in total support of you and your family and of Julian Assange. The founder of our show was Michael Ratner, as you know. He was Julian's first attorney here in the USA. And we're continuing in Michael's tradition in showing our support for Julian. And we'll continue to report on his situation and continue to support him till we get him out of there. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Godspeed, Mike and Jeff.
Thanks. You take it easy, John. So long.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We're always here for you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
RCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, rocks.
Actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona, but when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
WRCT. In sound from way out.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM like this.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we love monkeys.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From high
places.
And you're listening to
Loose, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
Black Lives Matter community. White supremacists on the mall, chaos. Where do we go from here? Chaos, challenging the legitimacy of democracy, or Black Lives Matter community, trying to forge connection between all concerned citizens to radically reorient the government back to its original purposes as articulated by the founding fathers. Chaos, white supremacy, community, love of all peoples. That's how we make a start.
That's Michael Eric Dyson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Michael Eric Dyson on Chaos or Community. In his 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here?, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these prophetic words. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. This may well be, Dr. King says, our last chance to choose between chaos or community. More than five decades later, the chaos is all too apparent. A raging pandemic with its mounting death toll, acute economic distress, a climate in peril, and the fury of the January 6th insurrection and all that was behind it. We are at a proverbial crossroads. What will it be, as Dr. King asks, chaos or community? Our guest today is Michael Eric Dyson. He's an internationally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, and is Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. Among his many books are April 4th, 1968, Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur, and Jay-Z, Made in America. This online event was hosted by the University of Colorado at Boulder and Metropolitan State University in Denver on January 22nd. And now, Michael Eric Dyson.
When I think about the legacy of Dr. King, born in 1929, died in 1968, 39 years old, didn't reach 40. In the process of his life, in the process of his career, in the process of his activism, he certainly was committed to notions of racial justice, of nonviolent, non-cooperation with a system of evil, non-cooperation with injustice, which is why he said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so when we look at Dr. King's legacy and ask, well, what is its relevance to what's going on now? We can turn to his most noteworthy speech. That is the I Have a Dream speech in 1963, August 28th. To mark the eighth anniversary of the death of Emmett Till. And as you all will remember, Emmett Till was the young 14-year-old boy traveling from Chicago down to Mississippi, supposedly whistled at a white woman, was abducted from his uncle's home in Mississippi, taken, shot, beaten, had a 70-pound cotton gin tied around his neck and tossed into the Tallahatchie River. And when they recovered him, his mother refused to have a closed casket funeral because his face was so hideously disfigured. She wanted the world to see the impact of racial hatred on the body of Black people. And so there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no Instagram, but there was Jet Magazine and the